A science fiction legend died this week. The man who coined the phrase sci-fi. His name? Forrest J. Ackerman. He was 92. He was a writer, a literary agent, and the force behind the magazine Famous Monsters of Filmland. He discovered the writer Ray Bradbury, and he amassed a mind-boggling collection of sci-fi and fantasy artifacts. Mr. Spock's pointy ears, Bela Lugosi's Dracula cape, and the pterodactyl that swooped in for Fay Wray in King Kong. Forrest Ackerman once told the Los Angeles Times how he came up with the phrase sci-fi. It was 1954. He said, "My wife and I were listening to the radio, and when someone said the word hi-fi, the word sci-fi suddenly hit me. If my interest had been soap operas, I guess it would have been cry-fi, or James Bond, spy-fi." Forrest J. Ackerman died Thursday of heart failure.
In the criminal justice system, Richard Belzer has played Detective John Munch on television for more than 15 years. And on 10 different shows, from Homicide: Life on the Street to The Wire, Arrested Development, and, of course, several different flavors of Law and Order, he's become so well-known as Munch, police cars will slow down to offer him a lift, and sometimes he'll take it. Here is his story. Richard Belzer's now applied whatever lessons you can learn about law enforcement by playing a cop to produce his first novel. It's called I Am Not a Cop, which is co-authored with Mike Black. Richard Belzer joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great. I love that introduction.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping you'd say that. Good.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just this thing is so universally recognizable, the Law and Order. I call it the Dick Wolf cash register sound. Every time you hear that, it means he's making more money.
Well, now...
Not that it's bad.
And making some money for everyone who works for him, too,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes.
Now, didn't... not a cop, of course, but didn't someone surrender to you once?
Well, when I was filming Homicide in Baltimore, we were filming a scene in an alleyway with police cars. Of course, there were prop cars and actors dressed as police officers. I had my bulletproof vest on, my badge on a chain around my neck. I was carrying a gun. We were rehearsing an arrest scene. And a real shoplifter ran around the corner onto the set. And he dropped the bag he was carrying and threw up his arms and surrendered to me. And then he said, "Oh, expletive, Munch." And a real security guard ran around the corner and tackled him and arrested him. It was funny because the guy had stolen Q-tips and film. So this is
Q-tips
not exactly top cappy.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. But that made me start me thinking about the convergence of celebrity and reality, particularly in America, the making celebrities out of virtually everyone. Paddy Chayefsky's network really was so ahead of its time. What was that, 1976? He predicted that the entertainment divisions would take over the news divisions, and he predicted reality shows. And, you know, it's just we're living it now.
Well, let's set up the premise of your novel a bit, because it's,
sure,
it's a character with your name who gets caught up in a case. He's having dinner one night in Brighton Beach, I guess.
I fictionalized my own life. Mm-hmm. And I've always been a huge fan of Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and James Cain and film noir. So that's one of my favorite things, is the counterculture, outsider, renegade guy who usually used to be a cop, then becomes a detective. But in my book, I'm calling it a meta-reality novel, where I take my life and I slightly fictionalize it, and I create this world where I have a friend who's a Russian immigré who came here. He's a very smart doctor who was a medical examiner. We meet, have dinner, and after dinner, he's mysteriously attacked by these two Russian thugs, and I dispatch them very artfully. And then he disappears, and I get caught up in it. And along the tradition of Hitchcock and Hammett, you know, where the hero, the so-called hero, is pursued by everyone and is trying to, you know, he's fighting the police, he's fighting the Russian mob, he's fighting his own studio. So I like that kind of thing where the reader is with the protagonist. And another thing I really like is voiceover and narration. So I get to do that in the novel. I talk to the reader.
Can you make portrayals of Russian organized crime figures these days that you can't about Italians and Sicilians?
I'm tired of Italian gangsters. Not that I don't watch The Godfather every morning when I get up. and Goodfellas when I go to sleep at night. But I've just always been fascinated by Russia as a country, by the Russian personality. And now Russia is literally a gangster nation. For them to spill over here, I think, is much more realistic than the cartoon, Arab terrorist.
Has your character, John Munch, changed over the years, or how has he changed?
I think in some subtle ways, he's become even more paranoid and more distrustful and more of a dissident. Mm-hmm. When we first did the part in Baltimore, a homicide, I wasn't quite sure how radical my character was. So in the first season of Homicide, I think I really got a grasp of who he was. I also met the detective who I'm loosely based on. That was really a great experience for me because he kind of looks a little bit like me, and he is a legend in Baltimore because he would come upon a crime scene and, you know, like somebody be decapitated and the guy killed his whole family and there's blood everywhere, and he would do a joke, you know, gallows humor. Yeah. And a lot of police departments love to have the court jester in amongst them because what they see is so nonverbal and so horrific and so soulless that someone comes in and cracks a joke. It's like, oh, thanks a lot. I mean, and I think that's why my character has such legs, as we say in the business, and has been able to last so long is because I serve a function. I think Munch is the spice that's much needed in that environment.
May I ask, is BB with you?
Bebe.
Yeah.
Bebe is not, and everyone's asking me that whenever we're talking about my dog, who I bring to work with me, who travels all over the world with me. And it's funny now when I go to premieres or openings, the reporters on the red carpet go, Bebe, look over here. Bebe, they don't care about me anymore.
Now forgive me for not knowing, but what breed is Bebe?
Bebe is a poodle fox terrier that was a stray dog. I live in France part-time, and this is a dog that was wandering around the village and followed our other dog home. Our other dog is a border collie mix, and Bebe's a little dog, and the little dog tried to mount the big dog, which was very funny and exhibited incredibly good taste. So we kept Bebe.
Fits right into the family, is it?
Yeah. No, they're a comedy team now, my two dogs. They're amazing.
Richard, a delight. Sure. Thanks very much.
I am not a cop.
I've heard. Boy, well, I'm glad we could finally get that clear for millions of people. Richard Belcher, known to millions as Detective John Munch, his new book, a novel, I Am Not a Cop. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Taylor Swift got a contract to write country songs in Nashville when she was just 14 years old. She released her first album in 2006 at the age of 16, and it became one of the most successful country music debuts in recent memory. Now she's released her second album, Fearless, filled with songs about teenage heartbreak and school romance. But rock critic Ken Tucker says there's music here that will resonate with many adults as well.
Take a deep breath and you walk through the doors. It's the morning of your very first day. You say hi to your friends you ain't seen in a while. Try and stay out of everybody's way. It's your freshman year and you're gonna be here for the next 4 years in this town. Hoping one of those seats you and say, you know I haven't seen you around before. Cause when you're 15.
When it comes to songs about the hopes and desires of a 15-year-old, you get the feeling that no one speaks with more authority and catchy precision than Taylor Swift, for whom 15 was pretty much yesterday. It would usually be a backhanded compliment at best to say that an album sounds like the diary entries of a young girl. But for Swift, it's a measure of her uncanny evocativeness.
I took a chance, I took a shot, and you might think I'm bulletproof, but I'm not. You took a swing, I took it hard, and down here from the ground I see who you are. I'm sick and tired of your attitude. I'm feeling like I don't know you. You tell me that you love me, then cut me down. And I need you like a heartbeat, but you know you gotta be straight. Makes me run for cover when you're around. And here's to you and your temper. Yes, I remember what you said last night, and I know that you see what you're doing to me. Tell me why.
It's not just the words, which of necessity are conversational to the point of barely bothering to rhyme. Swift's overriding goal is to create a feeling of intimacy among her peers, which precludes fancy rhetorical flourishes. But it's also in the music. Her melodies combine country, soft rock, and hard-edged folk to create a fine confessional mode.
You're on the phone with your girlfriend. She's upset. She's going off about something that you said. 'Cause she doesn't get your humor like I do. I'm in the room. It's a typical Tuesday night. I'm listening to the kind of music she doesn't.
That song features a little twang in the vocal and a little fiddle in the instrumental mix. But what it really is a driving pop song about being out of place, of being the second choice to a guy who wants to be with the popular girl instead of Taylor, who's busy identifying herself as a quote-unquote girl in the bleachers. That is to say, an observer, an outsider. If the setup is improbable, I'm reasonably sure a girl with Swift's impish smile was pretty popular even before she got a record contract. The songwriting and vocal performance is all intense ache. And intense ache is one of the best things adolescence has always contributed to modern pop music.
Hey, Stephen, I know looks can be deceiving, but I know I saw a lot in you. And as we walked, we were talking, I didn't say half the things I wanted to. Of all the girls tossing rocks at your window, I'll be the one waiting there even when it's cold. Hey, Stephen, boy, you might have me believing I don't always have to be alone. 'Cause I can't help it if you look like an angel. Can't help it if I wanna kiss you in the rain. So come feel this magic I've been feeling since I met you. Can't help it if there's no one else. I can't help myself.
One reaction you might have to this country music is to say, is this country music? Yeah, no matter how many millions of albums Taylor Swift sells, and her first one sold 6, no one is going to confuse her with Loretta Lynn or Dolly Parton or even a more pop-oriented country idol of hers, Shania Twain. But then again, how many teenagers are even paying lip service to country music as a vehicle for careful songcraft and impassioned emotionalism? 2 albums in, Taylor Swift is sounding less like a novelty act than like someone who already knows that a lot of us never stop experiencing those feelings of righteous anger, insecurity, and giddiness.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Fearless by Taylor Swift.
Well, almost 6 years after that, Richard Nixon resigned over the dirty tricks of the Watergate scandal. 3 years later, Nixon broke his public silence on Watergate in interviews with the British talk show host David Frost. The story of that TV face-off is now a movie. Bob Mondello has this review of Frost-Nixon.
There was something centrally disreputable about the Frost-Nixon interviews back in 1977. Nixon got paid a lot of money for them, which made them suspect as journalism. David Frost was a lightweight TV personality who wasn't even from the U.S., which made him suspect as an interrogator. And no one really expected him to outwit a seasoned politico who was, not for nothing, known as Tricky Dick. Least of all, Nixon himself or his advisors.
Frost is just not in your intellectual class, sir. You're going to be able to dictate terms, rebuild your reputation. If this went well, if enough people saw it, revised their opinion, you could move back east way, way earlier than we expected.
I guess it all boils down to Watergate, huh?
That's nothing to worry about, sir. It's not as if there's going to be any revelations. Stuff's been combed over a million times. No one has pinned anything on you.
On the Frost side of the equation, the calculus was a little different, but even Frost's researchers had their doubts. They wanted to give Nixon the trial he'd never had, but the wily old politician ran rings around his questioner in the first few days of interviews, and despair set in quickly for everyone except Frost.
I thought today was a huge improvement.
Are you nuts? Let me tell you how bad things were today. After the taping finished, I overheard two members of the crew say they never voted for him when they had the chance. But if he ran for office again today, he'd get their support. You're making him look presidential for
Frost sake. Nixon was originally written for the stage, where it depended so much on the notion of a David and Goliath mismatch, it could almost have been called Froth Nixon. That's less true on screen, though there's still something a little glib about Peter Morgan's script, which spends an awful lot of time making Michael Sheen's Frost a comic dilettante opposite Frank Langella's Nixon, who doesn't just look presidential, but kind of Shakespearean, a tragic figure rather than a guy who covered up a burglary. Happily, director Ron Howard takes a quasi-documentary approach that has the effect of giving Frost more heft on screen, news footage and behind-the-scenes shots of TV monitors, making it clear that he's better at using this emotionally cool medium than Nixon was, especially in the interview's big showdown.
What we were all doing was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry?
Langella's Nixon isn't an impersonation. You could find other actors who do that guttural growl more precisely. But he and Sheen are great foils for each other as the old man's defenses finally begin to crumble. Regardless, it's not their sparring, but the presentation of it that's meant to grab you, because a case is being made here that it wasn't really Frost who did Nixon in. It was Nixon's old nemesis, the TV camera, that unblinking eye capturing every bead of perspiration, every nervous shift of posture, every furrow in a guilt-ridden presidential brow. It's a case the stage version of Frost Nixon made an intellectual argument for, buttressed by a wall of TV screens. But theater being a medium of words and film a medium of images, here the case is made visceral, in merciless close-ups, blown up so much larger than life. I'm Bob Mondello.